So any questions from discussion group anyone would like to bring up?
Just a comment, really, that our group really is getting a lot out of today. This is like, this is a big day for all of us.
Big day. Yes, the mental afflictions usually are big things.
Okay. Anything else? Okay, then let's go back to this suffering and its causes chart, because we didn't quite finish it before lunchtime. So remember, this is really showing us how from our fundamental ignorance, our misunderstanding of reality, this grasping onto independent me, independent world, this leads to the mental afflictions, to our behaviour and to our experiences of dukkha. And as we saw, then of course the long-term solution to overcome suffering or dukkha is we need to eliminate ignorance by developing the wisdom of emptiness that we're going to talk about much later in the Vipassana section of the Lam Rim. So that's the long-term strategy. So as we began to look at before lunch, then it's also good to have a short-term strategy of how we can at least interrupt this process or minimize the negative impact of it. And so we were looking at that, and we got partway through it. And we saw, for example, back here at step number one, then one thing we can do is what's called this illusory-like emptiness practice in daily life of not simply accepting appearances, but questioning appearances. But again, to effectively do that, then that involves having an understanding of reality and actually doing some emptiness practice to have that confidence to understand that things are not really existing as they appear. And that can really reduce this grasping onto me, independent world. And at the second step, and this is a step that is very much emphasized in many Buddhist traditions, particularly the Theravada traditions are very strong on this, is to cut the process at the stage of feeling or sensation, is to simply not react to pleasant, unpleasant feelings or sensations in the mind or the body, is to simply observe them as they arise and pass. And this is a very practical point to really stop the negative impact of this process, and therefore very much emphasized in many of the Buddhist traditions. But of course, to be able to do this requires mindfulness. And so therefore, if we are really strengthening mindfulness through the shamatha practice, then in daily life, we're going to start to have that ability to be simply present and to notice when these pleasant and unpleasant feelings and sensations are arising in the body and the mind, and simply observe them and not react to them automatically as we do now. Again, as I mentioned earlier, we tend to be stimulus reaction machines, that some stimulus comes and we just react mindlessly out of habit. And so we're trying to break that, because a lot of our reactions are not very helpful. A lot of our reactions are in terms of attachment and aversion. So here we can begin to break that cycle by simply becoming aware of these feelings, pleasant and unpleasant, and not then reacting on the basis of them, simply allowing them to arise and pass. And then we also said here down at step three, one thing we can do is, this step three means that we're really seeing things as inherently attractive, inherently unattractive, is to also question, you know, is this thing really, is it attractive from its own side? Is it unattractive from its own side? And to understand that that can't be true, because different people see it in different ways. And so then to release that misconception that the beauty or the unattractiveness is in the object itself. And that can help also then reduce our attachment and aversion to that object. And then we got down to four, and that's where we sort of left off before lunch, where we, one of the effective antidotes or practices we can do at stage four is like the same as stage two, and that is simply become aware of our mental afflictions as they're arising. But again, to be able to do this, we need mindfulness, because the key here is to be able to catch these mental afflictions in the beginning. Because if they're starting to arise and they've become too strong, if our attachment, aversion or anger has got too strong, then we notice it. We're already out of control. There's not much we can do. Sometimes the only thing we can do is to cut from the object, to avoid going on to some sort of harmful sort of behaviour. So again, if we can develop this mindfulness, then we can start to notice these mental afflictions as they're arising. Then we're still in control, and again, we can simply observe these mental afflictions as they arise and pass. And a couple of benefits, of course, with doing that. One, of course, is that if we observe it, we're not feeding it, which means the habit of these mental afflictions coming up in the future is going to get weaker. Every time we get caught up in a mental affliction or we try to suppress it, we're feeding it, which means the habit of it coming up again in the future is going to get stronger. And also by observing the mental affliction itself, then of course we're not observing the object that's feeding it anymore. So there's nothing feeding the mental affliction because we're not focusing on that object that's feeding it. We're focusing on the mental affliction. So there's it can't grow, it can't go anywhere. It will simply pass. So this is a huge advantage. And again, here, I think this approach can also help us to overcome our old friend cognitive fusion. Because when something like anger comes up in our mind, we normally just simply identify with it. And this is also the way we speak and think. You know, when some anger's coming up in our mind, what do we normally think or say? I am angry. Cognitive fusion. We've just identified with the anger. We've made anger the subject. All we've really done when we think and say that is we've said, there you go, anger, you're the boss, away you go. We're out of control. Whereas anger is not, we're not anger. We can't be anger and have anger. We're not anger. So thinking I am angry is wrong perspective. And through doing this mindfulness, then anger remains an object because anger is an object. Anger is a mental affliction that's arising in our mind. It's an object in our mind. But when we identify with anger and we think and say I am angry, we've made anger a subject. We've made it us. Then we've lost, we're out of control. And actually, when I sort of mentioned this a few years ago in one of my classes, one of the ladies in my class, she says, "Yo, that's very interesting," she said. "This is what I do with my little children." I think she had two young daughters, I think 3 and 4 or 4 and 5 or something like that. And she said what she used to do, or at the time did, I think, is when they started to get angry, rather than saying, you're angry, she would tell them, look, there's that anger thing coming up in your mind again. And she said it was very helpful because it forced the child to go, what is that thing? Where? And it forced the child to look at their anger as an object and not get caught up in it. And she said it was very effective to help avoid the child getting caught up in their anger. So I think we can adopt the same thing, is really, anger is simply an object. It's a mental affliction arising in the mind. It's not us. And so then to keep it like that and just observe it, and then it has no power over us. But soon as we start thinking, I'm angry, we've just identified with it. We made it a subject. We've given it power. And then, of course, we try to fight with it, which gives it more power. So we don't need to fight with anger. All we need to do is not feed it. We need just starve it, just watch it. Because if we watch it as an object, it can't do anything to us.
Because if we look at what mental afflictions and thoughts are, I mean, they're virtually nothing. They have no power in themselves. They can only have power if we give them power by identifying with them or trying to suppress them. If we simply observe them, they can't do really anything to harm us. It's not like there is someone with a big stick breaking our bones in our body. They're just a little thought in the mind. And if we observe them arise and pass, then no problem. Yeah?
Can you say something about attachment to or craving for anger and hostility?
Attachment or craving for anger?
And hostility.
In what sense? What do you mean?
I think probably in the sense that actually brings feelings of pleasure because in certain conditions, when we're angry, we feel powerful.
Yeah, of course.
And maybe we feel righteous. I'm not sure.
Sure. So again, what we need to distinguish is between forceful behavior when it's necessary versus anger, which is always the intention to harm. And so, again, this anger, this intention to harm, is really a sign of weakness, that we can't deal with the situation effectively. We have to assert ourselves at the cost of the other person. And so, of course, this is not going to resolve anything. And also, of course, one of the things with mental afflictions is that we've identified with them for so long, that's who we believe we are. And so, unfortunately, often the case is better the devil you know than the one you don't. Mm-hmm. So often then people, even though it's really harming them, somehow they've got used to it so much that they don't want to change it, even though it's harming them and harming the people around it, because that's them.
You feel like you'd be losing yourself.
Exactly. In fact, often this is a thing that when we talk about liberating the mental afflictions, people say, but that's what it means to be human, to have mental afflictions, because we've identified with it so much. And then they say somehow, well, we won't be human anymore if we don't have these mental afflictions. I mean, that's very tragic. I mean, that's so much how we've identified with mental afflictions that we can't see any other alternative. Yeah. Again, I think the beginning point to break free of that is to stop this identification through the way we think, speak, and also through these sorts of mindfulness practices of simply being aware of thoughts, emotions, all of these things as they're arising in our mind, and to simply observe them as objects, because that's all they are. They're objects arising in our mind. They're not us. And as soon as we identify with any of these things, then we're in trouble. We're stuck. But let's say we got to step number 5, which means we've acted on the mental afflictions. And here I only want to focus on harmful non-virtuous actions. So if we've done a harmful non-virtuous action here, how can we avoid experiencing the result? Exactly. So here, then, we can engage in the four opponent powers. So we can have sincere regret for having done that action, reaffirm our positive direction in life, and in the Mahayana, of course, that's the taking refuge and cultivating the bodhicitta aspiration. Then think of some sort of practical remedy and then make a strong resolve not to do that negative thing again. And so that's going to very much weaken and damage that imprint. And if we do it effectively enough, then it will actually never ripen. But let's say we didn't manage to do that and we got to step 6. So step 6, again, we're having some experience. And again, I'd like to just focus on the unpleasant experiences that we have. What can we do at step 6 to reduce our suffering? Is there anything we can do, or forget it?
Not self-reflection.
How is that going to reduce our suffering? So what I'm talking about now is that we're in the middle of an unpleasant experience. We're experiencing it in the present moment. What can we do, if anything, to reduce suffering?
So reminding oneself maybe that this is part of being human, like you won't want the impermanence of it.
Yeah. I mean, that's one thing that can be helpful, is this too shall pass. So, yes, definitely.
Not to exaggerate it to ourselves. I don't know if that really counts.
Sorry?
Not to exaggerate it to ourselves. No, to
what do you mean?
Build it up in our mind or being more than what's really happening. Yeah.
I think what you're touching on here is, again, aversion.
Yeah.
And this is one of the key elements here. Is that it's our aversion to unpleasant experiences that actually produces most of our suffering, often. And I've got a concrete example to highlight this. Many years ago, when I first started meditating, I did one of these Goenka Vipassana retreats. And just before the retreat, I damaged my knee in a sporting accident. So I couldn't sit very long, cross-legged. After about 20 minutes, it started sort of hurting a little bit, and I kept moving, and it was okay. But then partway through the retreat, they have these sessions, one-hour sessions. They call it, I can't remember what was the name now, you have to develop, what's it called, strong determination, I think it was something like that. Strong determination. The idea being that to sit still with the body, because we keep moving, so to develop the ability to be still with the body to support the meditation, we had those sessions of 1 hour. Strong determination, do not move the body a millimeter. Well, not a millimeter, but, you know, unnecessarily. So I had strong determination, but after about 20 minutes, the knee started to hurt, but I was determined, so then it got more and more painful. But part of that, at that time in the retreat, part of the exercise was to just simply scan the body for sensations, like step two, and just observe pleasant, unpleasant sensations in the body without reacting. And then part of the instruction was, when you get to a point in the body where there's some strong sensations, just stay there a little bit longer. So, of course, I got down to the knee and there was plenty of heavy sensations happening. In fact, by that time, it was quite overwhelming suffering I was experiencing. But actually what happened was, if I could sit there with mindfulness and observe, what happened was this one singular intense painful suffering started to break up into smaller bits of pain, and it eventually, if I had very good mindfulness, it was simply thousands and thousands of intense sensations which didn't overwhelm me at all. I could happily sit with it. Soon as my mindfulness went, and soon as my mind goes, oh, I know what that is, that's pain, oh, I don't want that, go away. Soon as I did that, and of course not intellectually, instinctively, overwhelming suffering, like overwhelming. So I would say in that situation, more than 90% of the suffering I experienced was self-induced through aversion. There was some discomfort, but very minimal actually. It was giving me some signals, you know, you need to attend to it. And that was all that was there. But of course my mind was interpreting those signals going, oh no, no, I don't like that, go away. And then I had immense suffering. So I think this is the key here in point six, is to not have aversion to unpleasant situations. Because aversion is all that is going to do is magnify the amount of suffering we experience. So here we can follow Shanti Deva's advice, a great Indian master. He had very good advice on this. He said, if a situation can be remedied, why get upset? Just fix it. And if a situation cannot be remedied, what's the point in getting upset? Doesn't help. So again, if we have an unpleasant situation experience and we can resolve it, okay, resolve it, fix it, no problem. And if we have an unpleasant situation where we can't resolve it, then what's the point in getting upset? What's the point in having aversion to it? Doesn't help. All it does is it magnifies the amount of suffering we experience. So this is what we can do here. And so often in Buddhism, we have this idea of practicing what's called acceptance. But acceptance does not mean resignation. Acceptance simply means, in the present moment, I am having this unpleasant experience. I can either accept that fact, or I can deny it or try and push it away. It's our choice. And so with acceptance, then, if we can fix it, we fix it. If we can't, we simply be present with it. And at least don't magnify the amount of suffering we experience. So that's one thing we can do here. On top of that, and this is something we're going to start to talk about tomorrow, is we can use this difficult situation for our practice. For example, and I'll use another concrete example. Let's say we have a migraine headache. And let's say that in our experience, even taking medication doesn't really help much. We just have to wait it out. Then, of course, if we're having the migraine headache and we go, oh, not that again, go away, all that that will do is it will magnify our amount of our suffering. So the first step is don't do that. Is say, okay, it's there. My experience, I can't do anything about it. It will pass eventually. Okay. That's the first step. But on top of that, we can make this a meaningful experience. Because we can say something like, okay, I'm sure I'm not the only person on the planet with a migraine headache right now. There are probably thousands of people who are having a migraine headache or something much worse, in fact. So by me willingly accepting my migraine headache, may all others be free of theirs. So this is compassion. So we can use that difficult situation to develop compassion for others. And often what happens is if we are very sincere about that, that compassionate motivation often even overwhelms the discomfort we feel. You know, we see this often in examples like, you know, we hear this sometimes, like, you know, maybe there's been a car accident or something and someone's very badly hurt, but then they see their friend is in a very dire situation, and even though they've got like a broken leg or something, they will help them and they will not even feel any pain because there's so much compassion to help the other person. So similarly here is if we're having this unpleasant experience and there's no solution, then at least what we can do is use that to increase our compassion for others, and often that will even overwhelm a lot of the discomfort we experience. So that's another thing we can do, and we're going to talk about a little bit more about that point, I think, tomorrow and the following day as well. Okay, so that's the 6 points. Any more questions on that before we move on? Yeah?
When I was walking after lunch, I have this habit, whether it's a banana slug or a sunset, I'm like always going, oh, that's beautiful. So today I was adding, we're not the same, we're not the different. But is that type of response to seeing something, I didn't want to control it or keep it, I just was acknowledging what I was seeing. Is that part of this or isn't it?
Part acknowledging what, an experience?
Yeah, and is that part, is that, does that lead to suffering or?
No, I mean, that, of course, is, I think, simply acknowledging it like that is really stopping going here, is to, you know, it's just simply, oh, that's a nice experience. And so we're having a pleasant feeling and we're simply accepting that and not ending up going down this track here. So that's good. Okay. That's good.
What about saying the same thing? Like, I take lots of pictures, so I take a picture of it.
Yeah, again, often, and I did this in the past. I remember when I used to go traveling a lot in the first few years, I used to take pictures of everything. And then, of course, I never really looked at them later. And then I sort of, after some time, realized, well, actually, I'm missing out on the actual moment because I'm so worried about getting the right angle, the right distance for, and I need to go over here and there. And I just gave up. But, of course, if we are taking photos to then show to others and maybe inspire them in some good way, then I think that's okay. But for my own case, it was really like, oh, I have to get the perfect photo, you know, I have to be back, forward, here, oh, get out of the way, you know. You're into getting in the way of my photo here. And so for me, and then I, in the end, I never really looked at them. And so after some time, I understood that I was missing out. I wasn't really being present with the experience because I was too worried about getting the right photo. So for me, anyway, but I think other people who use their photography then to, I don't know, highlight certain things or inspire us, I think that's a good thing. Again, I think it's our motivation that counts. Yeah?
Can you just say one more thing about stain? I kind of spaced out.
Okay. Okay. So every time we have this grasping onto independent me, independent world, we increase the habit. So the seed of ignorance is the habit, so feeds it. But a side effect of this grasping is that this grasping stains our mind. And that stain of ignorance, what that does is it acts like a filter, meaning that when we come into, when we see an object, we're seeing it through the stain of ignorance in our mind. That's why this object mistakenly appears to exist independent of us.
Okay, and this is where you gave the green glasses.
The green glasses.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Then if we move on to the next outline in the text, so we are now... So we just covered the order in which the afflictions arise. Now the causes of the afflictions. So halfway down page 17, outline number, there's a number 3 there. The causes of the afflictions. And it says these are sixfold. So let's have a look at what they are. Because if we can understand what are the causes or the conditions that give rise to afflictions, then we can look at ways of working with those. And when it talks about the causes of the afflictions, as we're going to see, 3 of these are the necessary causes, and 3 of them are other conditions that can also contribute to the mental afflictions. So there are 3 there that are necessary for a mental affliction to arise. And the first one here, it says the basis. Meaning we need a basis for a mental affliction. What is the basis for a mental affliction, of course, is the seed of the mental affliction, the habit. So if we don't have a seed of anger, we can never develop anger. Unfortunately, we've all got a seed of each mental affliction, but for some of us, those seeds are stronger than others. So that's what basis means, the seed, the habit of that mental affliction. Then we have, I think they're listed in a slightly different, the second one is object. So of course we need an object for a mental affliction to arise. That object, of course, can be an external object or internal object. I mean, the object could be just a memory. A memory could provoke anger, for example. So, but we need an object. There needs to be an object for a mental affliction to arise. So we need the seed of the mental affliction, we need an object, but we need something else. And that something else here is actually number 6, attention. And it's actually what's called inappropriate attention. Inappropriate attention is to basically having a wrong perspective of that object. So, of course, examples of inappropriate attention would be to see these flowers as inherently attractive. That's inappropriate attention. And that can also
be at much coarser levels as well. You know, where we dwell on a particular object and then convince ourselves that, oh, we've got to have that. You know, that's going to make me happy for sure. So that would also be inappropriate attention. So this can happen at many levels. So these three are necessary. So we need all of these. We need the seed of the mental affliction. We need an object. And we need to be focusing on it in an inappropriate or a wrong way. From those three, we can have mental affliction arising. The other three factors here are other conditions that can also contribute to mental afflictions arising. So let's have a look at that. The third one here is social context. Normally they're listed in another order. So the next one normally listed is the fifth one, habituation. Here, habituation means that the more we habituate ourselves to that mental affliction, the easier for it to arise. So, of course, this is very closely related to the idea of the basis or seed. But I think it's listed separately here because to really appreciate that the more we allow ourselves to become accustomed to a particular mental affliction, then the much more easier for it to arise in the future. So that's habituation. And then the next one here was this social context. So this is factors of society. Normally here in the text, when it describes this social context or society, it talks about associating with bad friends. So what this is saying is that if we are associating with people who have a lot of heavy negative mental afflictions, then they can, of course, easily influence us in a wrong direction. So they can also easily then lead to us easily generating mental afflictions. So this is to understand that people around us can also have a very strong impact on our mental afflictions arising.
Is it just people or environments also?
But that's the next point. Is number six here is listed in the text. It's translated as explanation. And of course, what we're really talking about here is media. Is that, again, in the text, normally this point, it talks about false or wrong explanations. So what we're talking about here is then, in general, the media. You know, we're being influenced by all the different media and absorbing information that is not valid or not correct, and that often then leads to mental afflictions. You know, for example, a classic these days, of course, is all these computer games, these violent computer games. You know, we're you know, allowing ourselves to be inundated by this, and I think that's not going to have a very good effect on our state of mind and will probably help us to generate a lot of mental afflictions. So these are three things, three conditions that can contribute to mental afflictions arising, whereas these are the three core elements that need to be present for a mental affliction to arise. So knowing this, then we can look at ways of reducing the impact of each of those. So maybe we can briefly go through that now to see how we can reduce the impact of each of those points in terms of mental afflictions arising. Can we do anything there? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The interpretation, can it be something different, like, okay, something happened, but then how do we interpret the situation or the occasion?
I'm not sure. Are you referring to anyone in particular?
You,
or?
You say it's the media. And
oh, media you're talking about. Yeah.
Media
so
means the way the society view or something, right?
Here we're talking about exposing ourselves to historically it was to exposing ourselves to false explanations, but of course now we can broaden it to exposing ourselves to not only false explanations but media that promotes a lot of violence and so forth. This is what we're talking about here, that this sort of exposing ourselves to this can really act as a condition for us to generate a lot of mental afflictions.
I know, but I'm saying that sometimes psychologists are saying when something happens and it's how you interpret what happened.
Sure.
That caused the affliction. Is
of course.
What is happening. So that interpretation, the original text, the interpretation, does it have that? Oh, it's in there.
Yeah, I mean, that we can't have a mental affliction unless we interpret it in an inappropriate way.
Okay.
So, yeah, this is one of the causes, of course, but what we're saying is that these elements, in addition to these, can make it much worse. So what I'd like to do now briefly is have a look at what can we do here to reduce the impact of each of those. So what can we do here? Number one, the basis or the seed. How can we reduce that?
Live a good life.
So remember, we're talking here about, like, for example, seed of anger. Can we reduce the seed of anger?
Four opponent.
Yeah. So we can use the four opponent powers. We can also do positive antidote to it, like loving kindness. And of course, the ultimate antidote to all of these seeds or basis is the wisdom of emptiness. So we can, the long-term strategy is, of course, to reduce and eliminate all of this through the wisdom practice. But short-term would be to four opponent powers plus any positive opposite antidote, such as for anger, loving kindness, and so forth. What about object?
I'm sorry, back on the seed.
Sure.
I had read about ripping them up by the roots. Does that really just refer to emptiness?
Yeah. The only way we can rip out the seeds by the root is emptiness. Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, so the antidotes of four opponent powers is like lopping the branches.
Right.
We lop them and that's good, but then we keep lopping and then we rip it out. With emptiness, yes. That's right. Object. What about object? Can we do anything there? I think there's one piece of practical advice that can be helpful. Yeah.
Well, at least with internal objects like memories or ideas, we can try to be mindful when they arise.
Yeah, but that's more about this.
Yeah.
Yeah. The one piece of advice that can be helpful here is, as a beginner, there may be certain strong objects that always overwhelm us. So as a beginner, maybe it's good sometimes to take some distance from them. Of course, running away is never a long-term solution, but maybe an effective short-term strategy is to keep a little bit of distance. So, for example, if there's a particular person in our life, every time we see them, we get completely angry, then maybe not good to meet that person too often. But of course, keep them close to our heart, but maybe some physical distance while we work on our mind, so that later, when we're more stronger, we can then interact with them without getting angry. So again, if there are certain strong people or objects in our life that always overwhelm us in a negative way, maybe an effective short-term strategy is to take a little bit of distance from that. Inappropriate attention. Anything there we can do?
Appropriate attention.
Yeah. Again, I think it was maybe mentioned a little bit earlier,
is that this is often this sort of exaggeration that's going on. We're exaggerating things. So again, to the idea of inherently attractive and unattractive, we can reflect on that. And also, I think what can be good here is to really appreciate that these external things are not the source of our happiness or suffering. Because often this inappropriate attention is, that thing is going to make me happy. That thing is making me suffer. So I think part of this is to really appreciate and reflect on this, that these things are neither the source of our happiness or suffering. That can also help here, to not have this inappropriate attention. What about habituation? Mm. Can we do something there?
Cultivate a different habit, like in opposition to that?
Mm. Yeah, exactly. But one of the first things we can do is to acknowledge or understand that it's harmful to us to allow our mental afflictions to run their course. So we need to understand that having craving and attachment, it creates a lot of problems, and not just allow ourselves to have that. And then, as you said, then to habituate ourselves to the, sort of the opposite to that. What about society? Again, society, a little bit going back to the object here, is if there are people in our life that always overwhelm us in a negative way, maybe good to have a little bit of physical distance as a beginner while we strengthen ourselves. And the same thing then, as you mentioned, is the idea of sangha, you know, to get supportive people. So we don't have people who are generating mental afflictions in us, but people who are helping us to overcome mental afflictions and develop positive qualities. So this is something we can do here. And then media. Yeah, same thing. Any heavy negative media, you know, we don't have to spend all day sort of indulging in this sort of negative media.
Doesn't this kind of predict, like, you know, people believe everything the internet says? And that's exactly what, you know, they're like talking about that how long ago?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, of course. In the internet, we read some, oh, yeah, that's got to be true then, you know.
Right? I mean, you're kind of swayed. I have troubles even, you know, with it sometimes. And then it's like, oh, why don't you look at that?
One thing that I've really come to appreciate, you know, is, you know, often as adults, we think, you know, I'm an independent thinker. Impossible. Impossible. And I've come to really appreciate that, having gone through many countries. Because in the country, in every country, we are so heavily influenced by the media, without even really appreciating it, our views are so much informed by the media. And so even though we think we're critically thinking and that we're coming to a really sound, independent view, what I really can appreciate seeing people from different cultures, so heavily influenced by culture, it's scary. I mean, it really is scary. And we don't realize it. We don't realize it. And unfortunately, in many of our societies, the media is manipulating us because they know that that's what's going to happen. They pump so much a particular message in the media, and then we all just swallow it as if it's gospel, it's truth, because all the media is saying it must be true. Of course, you go to another country, and you think, hang on, that's not really the truth at all, you know? And that's really, I've come to really appreciate that from all of my travels, that, you know, it's very interesting when we get out of our own culture and then we can really see how much our culture is slanted in a particular direction and we don't realize it. We don't realize it.
I mean, I would just add that I don't think the solution is to withdraw from all media.
No. It's to have discriminating wisdom. That's exactly the point. Yeah, withdrawing is not a solution. The solution here is to not allow these things to affect us in a negative way. The solution here is to try to get good information, which is not so easy these days. But again, I think it is, you know, like in terms of world events, is to try to get different views and perspectives so we can try to see maybe what the truth is, where as opposed to whatever our media is saying the truth is, you know. No, withdrawing is, of course, not a solution. Okay. So these are the six causes here. And then now what I'd like to do is move on in the text, and we can go over onto the next page, on page 18. And there's a section here, how you die and are reborn. So I'd like to now begin to look at the whole death-rebirth process. Because here, in the suffering as causes chart, we're looking at the process of how ignorance leads to mental afflictions, leads to our experiences. But of course, this is happening life after life after life. And so now what I'd like to do then is have a look at how that process works. And that's a little bit explained here in these paragraphs here. It talks about causes of death, mind at death, where heat gathers and so forth. And what I'd like to do to sort of go through this a little bit is look at what's called the death process. And then based on that, then touch on a few of the points in the text here. So when we go through the death process, then there are a number of stages that we go through. And initially, it's this coarse body that begins to shut down. And in many of the traditions, also in Buddhism, the material world is described in terms of the various elements. And also within the body, the different aspects of the body we can describe in terms of the different elements. And these elements lose their ability to function at different stages through the death process. And we go through a number of stages in the death process. And at each stage of the death process, there is what's called the outer sign and the inner sign. The outer sign is what's going on in the body of the person. And the inner sign is what's going on in the person's mind. And at the first stage of the death process, it's the earth element that loses its ability to function. The earth element is a solid aspect of the body, the muscles and skeleton and so forth. And due to the earth element losing its ability to function, then there's an outer and an inner sign. And there are a number of outer signs, but I'll just give one as an example. One of the outer signs is that the person experiences their body, they often experience their lack of strength, and their body feels very heavy. Often they say it feels like their body is sinking through the ground. And an inner sign is that the appearances to the mind are not so solid and clear anymore. Is there more... The example here, the analogy is they're mirage-like appearances. You know, the classic example, of course, of mirage, you look out on a hot, sandy plain and there appears to be water, like shimmering. So the appearances in the mind are no longer so solid and clear, they're more like a mirage, sort of shimmering appearances. Of course, this is not with the eye, this is internal to the mind. At the second stage of the death process, it's the water element that loses its ability to function. The water element, with respect to the body, of course, is all the fluid aspects of the body. And so one of the outer signs is that the body fluids begin to dry up. Yeah, so often, you know, dry lips and so forth, yes. And as a result of this, then the internal sign is now the appearances are very hazy. So the analogy given here is it's like a smoke-like appearances. You know, smoke filled the room, everything's very hazy. So smoke-like appearances. But again, it really...
This means mentally?
Mentally, in the mind, yes. At the third stage of the death process, it's the fire element that loses its ability to function. The fire element, of course, is the heat aspect of the body. And so one of the outer signs is that the body starts to lose heat, particularly the extremities start to be cold. And the inner sign at this time is that the person experiences this like spark-like appearances.
Fireflies?
Yeah, often in the Tibetan tradition, the analogy they use here is like a firefly, because maybe in Tibet there must have been a lot of fireflies or something. But it's really just these spark-like appearances. Then the fourth stage is the wind element loses its ability to function. The wind element with respect to the body, of course, is the breath. So the outer sign is that the person stops breathing. The inner sign is that the person experiences a small light. Again, in the Tibetan tradition, often the analogy given here is like a candle light, but it just means small light. So, of course, here in modern medical science, then the person is clinically dead. The breathing stops, brain activity stops. From a Buddhist perspective, what's happened so far is that the coarse body has shut down. And since our coarse mind is associated with the coarse body, our coarse mind shuts down. But again, from the Buddhist perspective, there are a number of stages continuing. In the next three stages, it's the subtle body and subtle mind which are shutting down.
Is that describing a sudden process, or can that occur over a number of years? I mean, I think I'm at stage three.
Maybe you just have poor circulation.
But seriously,
yeah, no. If someone has like a slow terminal illness, yes, they could hover here for days or weeks. Yeah, it's possible.
I think in the aging process, though, that kind of describes, you know.
Maybe not to a full degree, I think. Okay, so the next three stages, it's the subtle body and subtle mind are shutting down. So subtle body, of course, we talk about what's called the central channel, and there are two side channels, and then lots of channels radiating out. And within these channels, we have subtle energy flowing, prana, or lung in Tibetan. And associated with those subtle energies, we have the subtle mind. And then also along the central channel, we have these things called chakras. And within Buddhism, chakras are constrictions. constrictions along the central channel. In other systems, I think chakras have slightly different meaning. And so this is the subtle body, and of course the subtle mind is associated with these subtle energies flowing in the body. And over the next three stages, the subtle body is slowly shutting down. And the subtle mind is, of course. The fifth stage is called white appearance. What that means is that at this stage, the subtle energies in the upper half of the body are withdrawing into the central channel and moving down to the heart chakra. Because of that movement, of course, there's no longer any outer sign because the coarse body is finished. It's nothing. But the inner sign in the person's mind, they experience a pervasive whiteness. So here, in this coarse level, there's very much a sense of duality, of them experiencing this appearance. Whereas here, there is still conceptuality or duality, but it's very subtle. So here it's much more of a sense of experience of whiteness rather than experiencing a white light. The sixth stage is called red increase. At this point, all the subtle energies in the lower half of the body are withdrawing and moving up through the central channel. And because of that movement, the person experiences a pervasive redness.
And again, moving through the heart.
Yeah. And so then at the seventh stage, it's called black near attainment. And what we're talking about near attainment, meaning close to attaining the actual point of death. And it's called black near attainment because now all the subtle energies have come to the heart chakra and they're enclosing the heart chakra. And because of that, the person experiences a pervasive darkness. So at this point, since all the subtle energies have withdrawn to the heart chakra, the the subtle body has shut down, and the subtle mind that's associated with that, of course, is shut down now. Then what happens at the next stage, stage eight, is called the clear light, or often called the clear light of death. And now what's happened is that the heart chakra opens and the very subtle mind becomes active. And as a result, the person experiences clarity. This clarity experience is completely non-conceptual. So these are the stages that we go through in the death process. And in a normal person, of course, as we do when we fall asleep, long before we're asleep, it's an unconscious. We're no longer aware of the process. Similarly here, well before this point, it often becomes an unconscious process. And then when we get to this point here, then this very subtle mind, which associated with this very subtle wind energy, the two together are often called the indestructible drop, they exit the body. And that's down where it says how you reach the intermediate state after death.
this outline four. It says, as the consciousness leaves from that spot, of course, is the heart chakra, when that disconnects, you die and you reach the intermediate state immediately. The intermediate state in Tibetan is called bardo. And the intermediate state, in the intermediate state, this very subtle mind and body then takes on a subtle mind, subtle body, and becomes a bardo being, intermediate state being. And that being is then looking for conditions suitable to take rebirth. And if we continue and look in that sentence, the next thing, it says, as to its causes, that is the intermediate state is contingent upon, one, having become attached to your body and being filled with delight in your previous worldly activities, and two, karma, whether virtuous or non-virtuous. And we're going to look at this in more detail tomorrow morning when we look at this 12 links. But very simply now, what we can say is that as we're going through the death process, then it feels like we're going out of existence. So we are literally craving and grasping to life itself. And that craving and grasping to life itself causes a karmic imprint to become activated. This is what we earlier talked about, this projecting karma. That activated imprint that is activated through the death process will determine what type of life we have in the future life. So then this bardo being is programmed by this imprint to find suitable conditions to satisfy that imprint. And so then in that intermediate state, then that bardo being looks for conditions suitable to for that imprint. The question, of course, is which imprint will get activated? Again, I think I briefly mentioned one time earlier was, to keep it simple, we can say that the heaviest one gets activated. And so again, if we've led a very good life, tried not to harm others, tried to help others, then the weight of our virtuous imprints will be heavy. One of those will ripen, we'll end up in a good place. If, however, we led a harmful, non-virtuous life, a lot of negative behaviour, then the weight of the negative imprints will be heavy. One of those will ripen, we'll end up in not a very good place. So this goes back, of course, to the discussion about someone of small capacity, that they would ensure that the weight of their virtuous imprints were heavy by abandoning the 10 non-virtues, engaging in the 10 virtues, and in the purification practice of the four opponent powers. So then in this intermediate state, then the bardo being is looking for conditions to satisfy that imprint. Let's say that the imprint that activated was to be human again. Then part of the necessary conditions would be for the sperm to be fertilizing the egg in the womb. And I think that's briefly mentioned in the text there. And then at that time, then the mind of the intermediate state being would conjoin with the fertilized egg, and then the new life begins. Now, how long does this bardo period take? It's not fixed, but within the Tibetan tradition, it's said that it takes a maximum of 49 days. And so often you find in Tibetan cultures, if someone in the family has passed away, they will do these sort of ceremonies or pujas for up to 49 days in the hope of having some positive impact on this bardo being. Yeah, there's a question down the back, yeah.
For someone that's achieved nirvana, do they go through the same process and do they become a bardo?
No.
So it's a totally different process.
Yeah, this is someone who's in samsara.
What if you don't really grasp after life on the way down?
Is that if we have ignorance, well, as we're going to see in these 12 links,
it's kind of impossible not to grasp.
Yeah, it's impossible. It's not like, I mean, if you've got ignorance, with ignorance, then there's a conception of self. Conception of self, there is grasping.
There's going to be grasping.
Is it usually excruciating pain during the process of dying or not?
No, and one of the things that it says here, actually, if we go back up a bit, it talks about dying with a virtuous mind, dying with a non-virtuous mind. That if you die with a virtuous mind, often you have this sense of passing from darkness to light. You have very pleasant and attractive images will appear. And then it says if you've really had a non-virtuous life, you experience going from light to darkness, and it may be many unpleasant images will appear to them, as if in a nightmare. So,
even like with a terminal illness, some people can die very quickly, and some this like 1 through 4 will take two to 3 days. Are there determinants?
Yeah, no. I mean, of course, often the question is, what happens with someone who has like dies instantly? Well, of course, this would collapse immediately. But what happens here? I've never found anything in the text that talks about that, so I'd only be speculating.
Okay, and there's nothing in the text that say some would take longer than others.
Yeah, I mean, of course, I think we can know from person's own experiences that often people, you know, can, if they have a slow terminal illness, they can often hover here for days or weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, we can see that easily.
So how is it that we know about 5 through 8?
Okay.
Good question.
Yes. A couple of methods. One is people sometimes have these near-death experiences, and from a Buddhist perspective, then a near-death experience would be, of course, someone's gone past here, they've stopped breathing, and they've got down somewhere here, but not to the point where the consciousness is left. And actually, it was very interesting. Some years ago, when I was explaining this in one of my classes, I had a young girl, I think she was Korean, after the class came to me and said, "Oh, that's very interesting." Because she said, when I was 18, I had a near-death experience. She didn't say whether it was accident or illness. But she said she more or less had the same visions or appearances down to the red. And then she remembers coming back from this red experience. So that was her. I mean, of course you could be making it up, but I doubt it. But also, the other thing we can know is that this process, this very subtle mind of clear light, is very powerful mind. And normally in a normal person, it's only active at the time of death. But in the Tantra or Vajrayana level of practice, there are methods to gain access to this mind in meditation. And so in those processes of absorb, and the way to do that is as similar to the death process, absorbing the subtle energies to the heart chakra. And when the meditators do that, they have these experiences. And then they report these experiences. And continuing on that point is that, but to do that in practice, even in practicing Tantra Vajrayana, extremely difficult. It's not easy at all. And so therefore, the high-level practitioners, of course, try to do that in their meditation practice, do this absorption of subtle energies and so forth. But together with that, they do dream yoga, sleep yoga, because they develop the ability to maintain awareness through the falling asleep process and then stay aware in deep sleep and dreaming, which, of course, is lucid dreaming, lucid sleep, and they can maintain awareness all the time. If we can do that, that is a sort of a preparation for this, to be able to maintain mindfulness through the death process. And so then if we can maintain mindfulness throughout this death process and we get down to this point here, then with mindfulness and awareness, we can harness this mind and meditate. And so the meditators who can do this at the time of death, that situation that they go into is called in Tibetan tukdam. Tukdam is where they're meditating in the clear light. And they can sit there for days or weeks and meditate. Of course, long before the breathing has stopped, brain activity stops. So normally in a normal person, then the body starts to slowly decompose. But there have been many cases of meditators sitting here for days or weeks in room temperature conditions and the body doesn't start to decompose.
And they're not breathing.
And, no, way long gone. I mean, in fact, my own teacher who I studied with for 7 years, Geshe Jumpa Gyatso, he was in the clear light for a week. And I wasn't there because it was some years later, but a couple of friends of mine were there. And he was just in his room in Italy in normal room temperature. And they said that when they went into the room, some of them went in there, and they said that there was a sort of like a sweetness in the air and that his face was glowing. And often they report that the meditator has a little bit of warmth in the area of the heart chakra. That's often reported as well. So there have been many cases of this occurring. Because at the time of death, this clear light mind, it naturally arises. You don't have to put any effort. All you need to do is to maintain awareness, and then there it is. And then if you can use that to meditate, and then you can realize emptiness, nature of reality here. And in the best case scenario, because this is a very powerful, subtle mind, you can achieve enlightenment. I think it's said that Lama Tsongkhapa, the author of this text, did this in fact. He achieved enlightenment at the time of death. Many cases of this occurring. And if not achieve enlightenment, at least accelerate the spiritual path.
If anyone's really interested in this, there's an amazing book called Sleeping, Dreaming, and Dying about the Fourth Mind and Life Conference in Dharamsala in 1992 with His Holiness the Dalai Lama.
Have you, I've heard of several stories, documented stories of Western saints who have not decomposed after they died. And I don't mean ones that without substantiation. And the smell and the warmth in the center, both of those things I've heard reported before. Do you know of any sort of cross-examination there?
This is something I think that His Holiness Dalai Lama is very much interested in, and he would like to study this scientifically. And I recently was talking with Richard Davison, a world-famous neuroscientist, and there have been a number of meditators that they've actually studied with this. And I think they haven't really, this only been fairly recently, so I don't think they've actually sort of come to any conclusion. But I think they have found some evidence that normally is not there in a dead body. So it would be very interesting if they can really come out with some very scientific-based data about what's going on at that time.
I'm wondering, shouldn't when they track down reincarnated lamas, shouldn't they be able to report the four last stages as well?
Right, okay.
I haven't heard.
So there's, on this point, it's a bit of a technicality, but we can talk about sort of three different terms. There's rebirth, and rebirth implies no control, that we go through this process based on our karma and mental afflictions, that that determines we got no control. Then, as we develop in the spiritual path, we can start to gain some control over the death-rebirth process, and we can navigate our way through, particularly someone who's had a direct realization of emptiness can really start to navigate their way through. If someone has that ability, then we usually don't use the word rebirth, we use the word reincarnation. And then, if someone achieves enlightenment, then of course they can keep manifesting in the world. So we wouldn't say they're reborn or they're reincarnated. We would say that's emanation. So there's a little bit of a technical point, but that's the difference.
Sure.
And related to that, then they, you know, we often talk about, in the text, talks about three levels of practitioner. And it's said that an advanced level practitioner delights at the thought of death. Because for them, they know it's an excellent opportunity, if not to achieve enlightenment, to dramatically accelerate the path, because they have the ability to tap into this clear light of death. Even though, even as an advanced practitioner, they may not be able to do that in meditation because it's extremely difficult. They practiced and they know, they're confident that they can do that. So often you'll find these advanced level practitioners often also, of course, have a lot of disciples. And so often what happens is as they're getting older and their body starts to not be supporting them anymore, they will call their disciples together and say, okay, it's time for me to move on, have a good life, see you later, and they'll sit down in meditation and just go through the death process and then stay in that tuktam state for days or weeks and meditate and in the best case scenario achieve enlightenment, if not, accelerate the spiritual path. So this is someone, advanced level practitioner. Then they talk about a middling level practitioner. The middling level practitioner, it's said, has no fear of death. Because that person, even though they have maybe not the ability to do the tukdam and meditate in the clear light, they have ability to navigate their way through the process. So for them, it's simply a transition to another life, so they have no fear. And then it talks about initial level practitioner. Initial level practitioner at least has no regrets at the time of death. Because they may have a little bit of fear about death, but at least they've made their life meaningful, they've done the best, and so they have no regrets at the time of death. So I think we can aspire at least to that, to have no regrets at the time of death. Any questions about what we've been covering? Yeah.
How do we know, or what is the criteria for knowing that a lama is reborn, like reincarnated? How do we
know this one? Okay. Often what happens, of course, is that high-level practitioners, there are probably other high-level practitioners around that have some connection. And so often when that person goes through this process, the ones of a similar level or who are associated with him, they will have some connection and maybe have some visions and so sometimes they have an ability to sort of know where that person has gone. So that's one thing. And then also what they do, they would, if they found a child they believed to be the reincarnation of some great practitioner, then they would often test the child, as the case with the Dalai Lama, is that they would typically, when the child is 2, 3, 4 years old, they would test the child by assembling a lot of items, where one of the items, like they would maybe have the bell of the ritual bell of the previous master, and then they'd have 4 other bells, and they'd put the 5 bells out on the table and the child would have to pick the one that belonged to the previous master. And they'd do a number of these tests and the child would always have to pick the right one. And they often try to trick the child by putting nice, pretty ones, you know, that the children normally would grab for. So they do this sort of test to try to validate that this child is the reincarnation of the previous master. So that's often what they do as well.
If I may, anybody that's interested, and I was able to bring it up in my group, it's about a film called Unmistaken Child that touches on that. So anybody else that's interested in that, the reincarnation and how they, you know, get it together.
Yes. Okay. Any other questions? Yeah.
Do the reincarnations and emanations also have the time period reentry?
Well, what I've described, this process, is the rebirth intermediate period process. With the reincarnation, I've never really seen... I mean, they would probably go through that sort of intermediate period, but it's said that they can choose where they go. So more than that, I've never seen any descriptions about if that takes some time or they can immediately go, or I've never really seen. All I've seen is that that person, and particularly someone who has realized emptiness directly, they take rebirth through the power of compassion, not through the power of karma and mental afflictions. But more than that, I've not seen any explanation, so I wouldn't know.
So going back a little bit for the water process,
sure.
And, you know, given the conditions, I mean, to me, it sounds like you're saying, let's say it's 49 days, you know, give or take. But
no, that maximum is 49.
Well,
and actually, on that point, what do we mean by 49 days?
49 days.
Do we,
for people on Earth.
Or does it mean 49 days from the perspective of the person who's undergoing it? So, you know, there's some discussion about this. I mean, generally, of course, people assume it's from their perspective. So that's why in the Tibetan culture, they spend 49 days trying to help that bardo
and
bit.
And
again, I think the 49 days, my understanding is this 49 days only exists in the Tibetan tradition. So, you know, what does
right.
it mean?
So, well, my question with that is, let's say, you know, in a given day, there's many people that die. And also in a given day, there's many people that, you know, are born. So, I mean, are the bodies waiting for someone to...
Well, remember, we're not talking about just being born as a human again. We have all the six realms.
Well, sure, but I mean, even that, I mean, is there always, like, enough people...
waiting?
Supply.
Waiting, yeah.
He's in a market.
Enough people waiting.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking...
For all the bodies.
Well, I guess the question is that...
So remember, of course... We are talking here mainly just about the human realm. And, of course, many of the other existences don't go through the same process of conception and so forth. There are other mechanisms for being reborn as well.
Right. So
and also we can talk about, from a cosmology perspective, we can talk about multiple universes as well.
Okay,
so we're not just talking about humans on this planet.
It means that every ghost and animal or human that is ever going to be in this universe is already exists because
the number of sentient beings is not decreasing or increasing. Yes,
right.
Yeah, that's correct.
That's part of this whole cycle.
Well, because otherwise you're talking about creating consciousness and destroying consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. That's right. Yeah.
Is there a finite number?
Good question. You know, in Tibetan system, they talk about sort of infinite sentient beings or so forth. But, I mean, what we can say is, according to the principles of consciousness, that the number, whatever it is not increasing or decreasing. I mean, more than that, it's difficult to talk about.
You mean you don't have a number?
No, I don't know. Well, not off the top of my head, no. Okay. To then just wrap up this section. One last question, okay.
There are so many species disappear from the world day after day. And where did they go? They are sentient beings.
Well, species, when we talk species, we're really talking about bodies, aren't we?
Yeah, there's certain rare species.
Yeah, I mean, so that physical form is no longer available for a mind to be born into because...
But then their consciousness goes somewhere, right?
Yeah, exactly. So in another type of animal or human or other type of being, there's... I mean, if you talk the numbers of some of the other realms is like, I mean, if we just look at the animal realm, I mean, the number of animals compared to humans is like, the ratio is like enormous, huge. And then some of the other realms are even like, between animal and those realms is the same. So the numbers of beings we're talking about is like beyond our mind. Okay, just to wrap up this section, I'd read a little bit more from Alan Wallace's book here, Tibetan Buddhism from the Ground Up, page 27. He says the following, and it's titled Death, Another Beginning. What does this theory say about death, which each of us experiences? It says that death provides us with no exit from the joys and sorrows, delights and tribulations of existence. During the death process, the body loses its ability to support human consciousness. The various sensory faculties, emotions and thoughts retract into a latent state, and a more simple, unmodified state of awareness emerges. When consciousness is thus reduced to its primordial state, free of conceptualization, there may occur a transcendent experience of ultimate reality if one is properly prepared for this event. Otherwise, one merely experiences a brief sense of spaciousness that is rapidly eclipsed by various types of visionary experience. At death, the stream of awareness that departs from the body is no longer human, though it does carry a vast array of latent impressions from the just-ended life as well as from earlier lives. These impressions are responsible for the type of experiences one undergoes during the intermediate period following death and prior to the next life. When this phase is over, if one is about to take another human rebirth, the stream of consciousness conjoins with the regenerative substances of one's parents, either during or after they join in sexual union, and conception takes place. During the development of the fetus, that awareness takes on the functions and attributes of human consciousness, namely, the latent impressions of human emotions, thinking, and so on, are activated. These three phases, death, intermediate period, and conception, are similar to the three states of deep sleep, dreaming, and waking. Understanding this, Tibetan contemplatives take full advantage of these states during the sleeping process by practicing techniques such as dream yoga and other meditations in which awareness is gradually retracted as it is during the death process. In these practices, great emphasis is placed on experiencing the state of clear light or primordial awareness, which ordinarily manifests just before death. There are tremendous advantages to this achievement because it helps the yogi overcome mental afflictions and obscurations, and it leads to the ability to choose one's next rebirth at will. Buddhists believe that the type of death, intermediate period, and rebirth we experience is determined by the way we lead our lives. Each act we perform leaves impressions upon our mind streams. Unwholesome deeds lead to suffering, wholesome acts lead to happiness and fulfillment. At death, the mental continuum that has been deeply cultivated by Dharma generally begins the next rebirth endowed with a comparable degree of spiritual maturity. So it is that the path of Dharma continues from lifetime to lifetime and culminates in the perfection of complete spiritual awakening, in which one is irrevocably released from all afflictions and obscurations. Sounds good. Okay, tomorrow, what are we going to cover tomorrow? As we see in our Lam Rim Chenmo outlines, towards the bottom of page 18, the next outline is about the 12 links. So I'm going to be looking at this diagram in detail tomorrow morning, particularly these 12 links around the outside. So on your second page, of course, there's a lot of information. You may like to have a little brief look at that before tomorrow morning. And then, of course, we are going to go on to page 19, We're going to talk a little bit here about the three higher trainings, ethics, concentration, wisdom. But, of course, the concentration and wisdom practice are talked about in a lot of detail later in the Lam Rim. So we'll briefly just cover the three trainings there. And then we're going to move on to looking at the path of persons of great capacity. So here, of course, the goal is to strive for not only personal liberation, but to strive for the goal of full enlightenment. And so here then, of course, the first part of that, we're going to look at how do we go about developing this aspiration of bodhicitta. So we're going to be covering that on page 20 and 21. So we'll probably get up to round about the bottom of page 21 by tomorrow afternoon. So that's roughly the material that we're going to be covering tomorrow. So let's break there, have a short break. Then in the next meditation, I think you're going to cover, we talked about these six causes of mental afflictions, so you're going to be reflecting on these, and then this evening, reflecting on some methods for dealing with anger and attachment. That's this evening. And then I'll see you tomorrow morning, so have a break. See you later.